You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world. Simulcast is television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide via the Free Speech TV Network, and carried on Progressive Voices on TuneIn Radio. Got to make those letters a little bigger. Welcome to our program. Well, the FBI has updated their gun statistics. Very interesting. The new ratio. Oh, and by the way, did you know that there are Sandy Hook truthers? In our third hour, we're going to be talking with Alex Seitzwald, who just did a piece on this. There's like this growing movement of people who say, no, there was no massacre at Sandy Hook. Those kids never existed. In fact, one of the Sandy Hook truthers actually called the mother of a five-year-old who died there and said, your child never existed. It's getting strange out there. And the number of bad deaths from guns, these are the latest FBI statistics for 2012. Last year we have numbers for 8,855 gun murders. That's in the FBI. The CDC reports 12,765. 38,364 suicides from the CDC, and 606 accidental gun deaths reported by the FBI, CDC reporting 120,859. That seems like a really high number. Anyhow, the summary on this thing. Justifiable homicides with guns, according to the FBI, in 2012, 258, 84 of those occurred in the home. So bad deaths, using the conservative numbers, not using the larger CDC numbers, just using the FBI numbers, 8,885 gun murders, 19,392 suicides, and 606 accidental deaths. Bad deaths, 28,853. Good deaths, defensive deaths, 258. 28,000, at the home level, only 84. So 28,853 deaths divided by 84 gives you the cost-benefit ratio, 343-1 negative payout. So just wondering what Neil McCabe may have to say about this. Neil McCabe is a conservative commentator, the editor of Guns and Patriots newsletter for Human Events over at gunsandpatriots.com. Neil, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom. It's really great to be with you. Two things real quick. One,
yes.
I never thought I'd hear see the day when you would say that you were using conservative numbers. And the second thing is, it turns out that all those times I wasn't boring those girls. I was just making their brains hot.
Oh, you're talking about the yawning story in the news.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Some people didn't hear our newscast, but it turns out in our newscast, it turns out. Yeah, I'm sorry to hear you were making girls yawn, Neil. It turns out that
making their brains hot.
Yeah, there you go. The reason people yawn is not because they're bored. It's not to get more oxygen. It's because actually your brain is overheated, and we yawn to cool down our brains, which is fascinating. Anyhow, Neil. You know, you're a gun guy. The odds of a bad death versus a good death, if you have a gun in your home, 343-1. That sounds like pretty bad odds. I don't think you'd go to Vegas with odds like that.
Well, of course, every death is a tragedy for someone, and who knows what road brought them to those places. But I think one of the ways you can sort of divide up these statistics is rural and urban. The vast majority of these gun deaths or firearms deaths in urban communities, they're going to skew young and they're going to skew homicide, whereas in rural communities, they're going to skew towards suicides and it's going to be older. Older people, in fact, you take a state like Wyoming where, there's virtually no homicides, but it has the least homicides of any of the 50 states. and yet their suicide rate is percentage-wise is as high as anywhere in the world, and that's mostly older people alone with a gun. And of course, drugs and alcohol also mixed into this. It's really, you know, it's on both sides, both the urban and the rural side, and so you know that makes it more difficult to deal with. But certainly, I think if you're asking, should someone have a gun to protect their family or their business or their property, if they feel that that's what they need to do, they should absolutely have the right to do that. There's no obligation to be a victim.
The basically what you're saying, and I of course there's no obligation to be a victim, but you know, the vast majority of people, the vast wild majority, nobody has ever done any numbers on these. Over 20 years ago, the NRA hired a guy to call 5,000 people and ask them if in the last 12 months they had used a gun defensively, with or without success. And based on the answer that he got, that this researcher got, they extrapolated that there are between 1 and 2.5 million successful crime prevention uses of guns every year in the United States. The study is so flawed. I mean, Harvard University actually issued a peer-reviewed paper ridiculing it.
Sure.
It's full of sample bias. It's full of what's called telescoping bias. Most people, if you ask them if something happened in the last year, if it happened to them 12 years ago, they'll still tell you yes. It's full of, you know, there's no evidence to base it up. I mean, somebody might have said, yeah, of course I did. They were not asking for the details. I mean, it's just, so the odds of you ever needing to use a gun are so low. And yet, as you correctly point out, we're seeing an epidemic of suicide, particularly among our vets right now. It's something like, you know, one every hour a veteran is taking their life in the United States. And suicide and homicide by gun are far more frequently crimes of impulse or actions of impulse. I'm not sure you'd call suicide a crime. Actions of impulse than they are actions of well-thought-out intent. And what we see from other countries, and in fact what we can see from state-by-state analysis in the United States, places where guns are easily available and you know, widely available versus places where guns are not widely available, is that suicide in particular, I mean, suicide is huge for this, but homicide rates as well drop when the number of guns available drops, because somewhere on the order of probably 70 or 80% of all suicides are impulsive, and somewhere on the order of around half of all homicides are impulsive. So shouldn't we be working to limit the number of available guns and leave it just to those people who actually have a need for a gun, or are, you know, like target shooters, like my brother and I, who actually are smart enough about it to lock them up?
I mean, because I can't control someone's impulse for suicide or homicide, and because someone down
the street... But you can control whether they have a gun or not.
I don't know why I should be the one who's a victim. I don't know why, because there might be a crime sometime in the future, I have to give up my rights. And
because as a society, it keeps us healthier. Because it's not just about you, Neil. It's about all of us.
Well, I mean, this world would be a much happier place if everyone asked themselves, how does this affect Neil? I mean, that's a given.
Unfortunately, but, that's the worldview that is presented,
but, you know. But, you know, you just talk about Sandy Hook. I mean, I'm not a Sandy Hook truther, but certainly we know that if somebody was armed, that thing could have been over in a minute, not 15 minutes, when the police arrived and found everyone dead.
Yeah, although that didn't work in several other mass shootings, including, several of those high schools where you had armed guards and they ran in the wrong direction. But anyhow, Neil McCabe, Neil, your point is made. Neil, gunsandpatriots.com is the website. Neil, good talking with you.
All right. Good talk. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Neil McCabe, gunsandpatriots.com. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Nate Sweet on the line with us, international media superstar and producer of The Big Picture. Hey, Nate.
How's it going, Tom?
Good. So, tonight, we're going to start out with a segment on the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, SHAFTA, also known as TPP.
Yeah, it's probably, you know, maybe the most underreported story in the world, or maybe in the country right now, is TPP, SHAFTA, and its European counterpart, the TTIP. We're going to focus mostly this.
That should be called Shaft U.
Yeah. That was good. That was a good one. I wish I were quick enough to come for that one. But, you know, this is a really underreported story, and since it pretty much covers all aspects of the economy, one of the areas that's going to be really affected by TTP and TTIP, SHAFTA and Shaft U, is going to be food safety. It basically pushes our food regulations to the lowest common denominator of the countries involved with these treaties. And obviously,
right.
Considering what we know about our food safety system already, that's going to have some pretty...
I saw this mind-boggling article in the New York Times Magazine, Sunday Magazine, back 6-8 months ago, complete with photos of the way that they grow, particularly tilapia, but the way that they grow these food fish in China. People have, like, ponds in their front yards of their houses, and their wastewater, I mean, their septic is running into these ponds, there's industrial waste running into these ponds, you can't even see through the water in many cases. And they're growing these fish, and then they sell them on the international market, and this is what's ending up, if you're ordering tilapia in a restaurant in the United States, odds are that's where it came from. And it was just mind-boggling, this article, absolutely mind-boggling. The photographs with it were the grossest thing I ever saw. And those standards, which are basically no standards, I mean, this fish is contaminated with pesticides and herbicides and human fecal matter and all kinds of things. Those standards will become the standards of the United States if SHAFTA TPP is passed.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you have to remember about TPP is imagine every single bad aspect of deregulation and free market policies, and that is going to be on steroids when it comes to TPP and TTIP.
Yeah.
And then in Block B, we're going to be talking with Richard Eskow from Campaign for America's Future. They have a new campaign focused on the broadening populist consensus within American politics. A majority of people support government intervention to reduce economic inequality. A majority of people support raising the minimum wage. This is across party lines. They're trying to rally support around this new consensus
right.
That's emerging.
And you are going to pull us out from our conversation with Ralph Nader about that. Right?
Yeah, that,
cool.
Ralph was talking about that specifically in regards to working with libertarians on an issue basis.
Yeah, I think absolutely. And for the best of the rest, can we bring back, how about a basic minimum income? Let's finally put into place Thomas Paine's idea.
Yeah, Vermont actually just is getting ready to pass, or just has passed, the highest minimum wage in the country, $10.50. But a lot of people are thinking we need to, you know, expand the conversation even further. We talked about what actually is income and, you know, whether or not we need to move beyond just the wage system towards a guaranteed basic minimum standard of income. We'll be debating that with Sherrilyn Hardy-Lebon, former U.S. Senate Judiciary Counsel, senior counsel. She's with Project 21, Black Leadership Network right now. And she's always good for a debate. We'll be debating basic minimum income with her.
Okay. Do you know if our free press person came through for the net neutrality discussion? I see efforting.
Yeah. Chancellor Chance Williams is on the board for right now.
And cool.
If anything changes, we'll obviously have more updates on that. But we'll be talking about the FCC's proposed revision to the proposed rules.
And in our daily take, we'll be talking about Clive and Bundy, the new ugly American.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. Nate, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll see you tonight. Right. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman program. I should add the NRA's the gun statistics that I was quoting were from a blog that was up yesterday over at Daily Kos by Water Street 2013, titled NRA Roulette, FBI Updates Gun Ownership Cost and Benefit Ratio, The Costs Win Big Time. And tip of the hat to Water Street 2013 for doing that. For pulling these statistics together and laying them out in a very straightforward fashion. It's really quite remarkable when you look at the numbers. It's really quite remarkable. And yet the NRA still. And then there's a piece, the Bergen County Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence wrote a great piece called Debunking the NRA Talking Points on Self-Defense, where they said, you know, this million people use a gun to defend themselves every year. It's not only is it 20-year-old data, but it's also nonsense. Bullpucky, as they say in sophisticated circles. So, anyhow, there's that. There's also the other thing that really caught my attention, and it just horrified me, is this past weekend, there's this place near Blanding, Utah, called Recapture Canyon. And Recapture Canyon is not the name that was, it's a great name for Clive and Bundy type, you know, hey, we're going to recapture the land, but that's actually the name of it. It's an old, old name. Probably goes back to some battle with the Indians. And the Navajo Nation has a burial site there, and there are ruins there of ancient cities, like thousands of years old. And that's the reason why, while you can ride horses through this part of the national forest or the national park, you can't ride an all-terrain vehicle, because ATVs rip up the land. In addition to being loud and obnoxious and smoky and you know, pouring out carbon pollution and all that other stuff, they rip up the land. But a bunch of yahoos put together an ATV ride through the canyon this past weekend. And Clive and Bundy, whose 15 minutes of fame has by and large passed, decided that maybe he could get back in the national spotlight if he pushed this thing. And so he tweeted out or Facebooked out or whatever, emailed, you know, the deadbeat rancher, the guy who's been grazing his cattle on your land and mine. And, you know, while the Koch brothers do this, they pay, you know, a buck or so per cow per month for grazing rights. Now, if you did it on private land, it'd be $5-6 a month, but per cow. But Clive and, you know, at least the Koch brothers pay their fees on the big ranches that they have in three states. But Clive and Bundy, he hasn't paid his fees in 20 years. So anyhow, he encouraged his supporters to go there. He says, we need the help of the people of Blanding reestablish who is in control of this land. This is your next stand. Will you be there to help them like you helped us? By the way, please donate. It's amazing. In fact, it says the Salt Lake Tribune reports that Lyman, the guy who is putting this thing together, Utah County Commissioner Phil Lyman, says that the planned ride aims to assert county jurisdiction in the face of federal overreach. Now, what this goes back to is that before the Constitution was put into law, it was introduced in written in 1787. It was introduced in 1790. As I recall, it was ratified in 1791, and that was the year that the United States, in its current incarnation, kind of rebooted itself, and George Washington was made our first president. But prior to that, there had been a period of about a decade where we had won the Revolutionary War. We had 13 states, and we had at least three presidents, might have been four, and all of whose names are lost to history. I used to know them, and I don't even remember them. And it's basically each state was an autonomous nation, and they interacted with each other through sort of a large free trade agreement. It's very much like the European Union, actually, only actually less restrictive than the EU policies. And this was called the Articles of Confederation. And so we had a country that was operating for a little less than a decade under the Articles of Confederation. And under the Articles of Confederation, the supreme judicial authority, the supreme authorities, were the county and state governments. And the county governments had the principal police authority, because they didn't even trust the states. That all got it done away with the Constitution when we became a country in 1791. But these guys don't believe in the United States as it's constituted, as Clive and Bundy has famously said. He doesn't believe in the United States. That whole "we the people" thing, the first three words of the Constitution, forget it. We don't recognize that. What we recognize are county officials. They are the supreme officials of the land. The county sheriff is the highest level of law enforcement that exists in the United States. And which is why Clive and Bundy, you know, made this appeal to county sheriffs across the United States to disarm federal agents. Go into your local FBI office and take away their guns because you have the authority. Now, apparently nobody has told Clive and Bundy and his buddies, like this Utah County Commissioner Phil Lyman, that we ratified the Constitution. It was accepted by all the states, ultimately. And we elected George Washington as president. And we've continued since then under a new set of rules. So that's part of what really offends me. The other part is what they're doing, how they're desecrating the American.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, they're desecrating the American Indian lands, the Navajo lands. And this is particularly offensive. I'm going to riff on that when we come back, and we'll pick up your calls. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. My TED Talk just went live on YouTube. We'll have to get a link over on. We don't have a link yet on our homepage. I'm pretty sure. Maybe we do. There is. Oh, Sean already put it up. Cool. You can check it out. It's called Lincoln Didn't Fight the Civil War to Free the Corporations. You can guess what that's about. And by the way, if you're in Clinton County, Iowa, which is the town of Goose Lake, Iowa, the Clinton County Democratic Hall of Fame is having a dinner this coming Saturday, May 17th, and their featured speaker is going to be Senator Bernie Sanders. So if you are in Iowa and you want to check this thing out, get over to sanders.senate.gov and get the details. And if you show up, be sure to tell Bernie I said hi, would you? So anyhow, that's... We were talking about Clive and Bundy and his buddies, you know, going out and basically desecrating these Indian burial sites. And in my mind, this just exemplifies this mind view of what we used to refer to, and I think we should still, as the ugly American. I mean, it's the ugly American who drives an ATV through a Navajo burial site and over 5,000-10,000-year-old Indian ruins. It doesn't get uglier than that. And who says to the federal government, we're going to ignore your having set this land aside because it's sacred to these people who are still alive, by the way. We're going to ignore your having set this federally owned, publicly owned land aside so that you can only travel through it on horseback. We're going to ignore that, and we're going to take these ATVs, and just, you know, rip up the land. This is about as asinine as it gets. This is about as ugly American as it gets. What kind of bizarre mentality produces this? I just find the whole thing mind-boggling. Mark in Sun Valley, Idaho. Hey, Mark, what's up? Mark, you are on the air if you're listening to your phone. Apparently, Mark is listening to his TV. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. You are listening on TuneIn it must be Progressive Voices.
I don't know. I just went to TuneIn and search for you, so I guess it is Progressive Voices.
There you go. Okay. Jeff, what's up?
Well, this subject's very close to my heart. I spend a lot of time out in, I live out west, and I spend a lot of time in Utah,
mm-hmm.
and many other places. And not too far from this Recapture Canyon and so forth, I've been in parts of the desert where ATVs are not legal, and you see the desert is torn up everywhere.
Oh, and not only that, that while normal land will recover in one growing season, this desert land, it can take 15 or 20 years. I mean, literally, I've been out in the desert of Arizona hiking and seen areas where you see tire tracks that are clearly like Model A kind of tire tracks. I mean, you know, they're like 80-100-year-old tire tracks.
Yeah, well, what you have there is you've got cyanobacteria. There's a layer of algae, blue-green algae, that grows in the desert. It forms a crust to protect the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And you see down around Moab, all the bicyclists are very, you know, they really push hard about knowledge about this, that you stay on the trails, you don't break this crust.
Right.
And as soon as you get a motor on, people, you know, can travel about 100 times more distance. And I've, you know, frequently camped in the National Forest and such and seen ATVs, spinning circles, things like that. I used to live in the Grand Teton National Park, and I've directly witnessed four-wheel drive trucks creating new trails, you know, doing hill climbs in the park illegally.
Yeah.
And so, like, this one part near Goblin Valley, Utah, you just see everywhere it's just torn up soil.
Yeah.
And so, that, you know, people like this can cover, you know, tear up thousands of times more soil than they would on a horse or on a bicycle. Bicycles and horses tend to go pretty straight in these areas.
Yeah.
Where ATVs just wander all over. I mean, I used to do dirt riding myself, and I stopped because a lot of the motorcycles I rode with here in the Colorado Rockies would be creating new trails.
Yeah.
Next to signs that say stay on the trail.
So Jeff, what do we do about this? I mean, the BLM is charged with stopping this, but their budgets are you know, always under fire. The Republicans hate them, and they don't have enough people. They can't be an effective police force. And then on top of that you get these like organized protests in quote where they go out and desecrate Native American sites and Fox hails them as heroes.
Well, a lot of it, you know, like with the bicycles, again, we have organizations that, you know, really promote this. And there are a lot of ATV and four-wheel drive organizations promote this, too.
Promote this kind of behavior or promote responsible behavior?
Promote protecting the cyanobacteria.
Oh, so they're promoting responsible behavior.
Yeah, but all it takes, the thing is, again, you know, any motorized vehicle can create much more damage. And there are plenty of yahoos, even though there may be good organizations. There's a very big percentage of people who do not honor that.
Yeah,
I've got, you know, been in wilderness areas and been walking up the trail, and they had an ATV coming the other way. All motorized equipment is outlawed there.
Right.
And yeah, it's also pretty interesting that Bundy's involved in this, because I've been at times, you know, camping out in the National Forest, and it's day after day, it's hard to find a place that hasn't been, you know, where there aren't cow patties.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot more damage than people realize, and how to deal with this. Yeah, it's the hard part, because there are always going to be yahoos. So even though there are good organizations for ATVs and four-wheel drives, there are people who, yeah, education is the best thing, but I don't know if there's really a good answer.
Yeah, I think that education is really all we can do right now as a starting point, is wake people up and call these people out for what they are. You know, they're the equivalent, the American equivalent of the Taliban. This is like the Taliban blowing up those Buddhas, you know, in Afghanistan back in 2000. And everybody was so horrified by it, and because they were destroying, you know, centuries old, maybe millennia old cultural artifacts of another culture. This is the same thing. You know, these guys are the modern day Taliban. They have that little respect for ancient cultures. Anyhow, Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Louise in Denver. Hey, Louise, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, you know, living and being raised in Colorado, mm-hmm. we know in Colorado, when you go around any Indian territory, such as around Mesa Verde, there's a lot of Indian burial grounds. We know that when you go down there, you treat their land with respect. You treat their burial grounds with respect, almost with reverence. And it is, you know, we always thought it was a myth. But in this case, I hope it's not a myth. The myth is, if you go to their sacred burial grounds and you are not respectful, there will be a curse that will come upon you. And in this case, Tom, I hope it's true.
Well,
these,
you know,
hooligans.
I remember going to Savannah, Georgia, has some amazing old, early pre-revolutionary burial, you know, cemeteries. And when my mom was alive, she used to do a lot of genealogy work, and she would go to these cemeteries and put a piece of paper on the stone and rub a pencil on the back of the paper, you know, to lift the letters out that were almost unreadable. And mm-hmm. for some reason, in the cemetery in Savannah, they have these long stories on the stones about the people, you know, and or poems about them. And sometimes they call them out, you know, he was a real cretin, or he was a really terrible guy, but, you know, at least he lived till he was 50 or whatever. And can you imagine if somebody said, hey, let's organize an ATV thing to go out and run over and smash up a white people's burial ground?
Oh, Oh, they would have the rifles aimed right at them. And I tell you, because of what happened in Nevada, and these people, their mugs were right in the cameras. They were being interviewed, so they know who they are.
Oh, yeah.
The ones that were carried sidearms, they should have been arrested right there on the spot, and this is going to lead to a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is bad. Louise, thank you for the call. Jack in Chicago. Hey, Jack, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me. I'm an union electrician in Chicago. The thing that hit me was I love all these people from these states that want to secede from the union or not have anything to do with the government, love our tourism. They love us having to go to Las Vegas, Reno. Texas wants to secede from us, but they put commercials on the TV about come visit Austin and every place else. How do you think we get there? We all have regulations. The airlines all have regulations run by the government.
Yeah, yeah.
If it wasn't for that, how would we get there and give money to their states?
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. I flew back. I this weekend I was up at Northampton, Massachusetts, for the 10th anniversary of Progressive Democrats of America and for a memorial for Tim Carpenter, who died last week from cancer. And on the way back Sunday morning, I took a flight, and it was a commuter flight from Northampton to D.C. And the woman who sat next to me had never, ever before been on an airplane. She was, you know, probably in her late 20s and was just scared to death. And so I tried to reassure her, and she was like, what do you know about this? And, you know, and so I pulled my pilot's license out. I said, I'm a pilot. And you know, you don't have to worry. And she's like, what's that? That's a wing flap, and this is how it works. And then I said, you know, the government regulates this stuff really well. These airlines, she says, what about that plane that vanished, you know? And I said, that was in Malaysia. Malaysia doesn't, you know, give a rat's patootie about their aviation. But in the United States, the government regulates the airline industry really, really well. And, you know, things are pretty damn safe here. And she was like, well, thank God for that. And just, you know, I didn't turn it into a political moment, but your point is real, really well taken. Thanks a lot, Jack. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I also discovered that when you're going through a little bumpy air and you turn to the person next to you and say, can you remember the last time you were on a carnival ride and enjoyed it? Suddenly they start smiling. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Quarter two. And Richard watching Free Speech TV in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Richard, you are an ATVer?
Yes. And I'm completely brokenhearted because we've got the double whammy. We get the Conservancy will buy the land up, and then they'll close it all off basically to all access. And I'm disabled too, so I kind of have to use my ATV to get around.
Uh-huh.
And then you get the other people that come from out of the area and buy up the property, and they close it off. Mm. And it all leads back to people trashing the land.
Yeah. Aren't there areas, I mean, you're in Michigan. I grew up in Michigan, and I had friends who, about the time that I left Michigan in 78, and that was just when ATVs were starting to get popular. And, in fact, I think they probably weren't even invented until the early 70s. Correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know,
they've been around for a while.
Yeah, but before that, I mean, that as the three-wheelers. Before that, it was the dune buggies and the Jeeps and that kind of thing. But, but in any case, I thought that there were areas that were set aside specifically for ATV use, for recreational driving on, you know, it used to be, like I said, Jeeps or dune buggies and then ATVs. Are there not?
Well, there are some, yeah. And we actually, we have an ATV club up here that is trying to get more land in areas so that we can ride and enjoy more parts of the scenery. Because, like, we're way up north. I'm up in the Keweenaw Peninsula.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And, yeah, I'm a stone's throw from Lake Superior.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's...
And you're in the middle of nowhere, basically. I mean, there's...
All kinds of cool things to climb around up here.
Yeah, yeah.
But... Like I said, you get people that'll trash and bust bottles and kids at parties.
So so you find yourself, I'm guessing, probably in the same position my brother Steve and I do, who are, you know, and Steve more than me because he actually owns the guns and I just go and borrow his. But, you know, as competitive shooters, people who want to defend the right of people to own guns, And yet there are people who say, but wait a minute, you know, guns are so irresponsibly used, we should just ban all of them, something I disagree with. You know, there are responsible ATVers, and the
yep.
problem is that there's do you need a license or anything to use them?
No, but there are stickers that are required, and actually they raised the rate considerably this past year.
Well, yeah, that's because, you know, Rick Snyder is trying to figure out ways to get money into the state coffers without raising taxes on billionaires.
Yeah, I wish some billionaires, because, but we get a lot of out-of-staters yeah. that come up here.
What would you think about
four-wheeling?
Yeah, you know, if you're driving in most states, if you drive a motorcycle instead of a car, you need a different kind of driver's license or an endorsement on your driver's license to demonstrate proficiency. What do you think about an ATV license like that, so that you know that might weed out some of the yahoos?
I don't know. It's because up here you got so many people. You're supposed to have even a driver's license. You got so many goofballs up here that lose their license from drinking and driving, and somehow they manage to get stickers and they still drive all over the place.
So they're on the ATV. Huh.
Oh yeah, and it's even worse because when you do something stupid on an ATV, it's usually pretty unforgivable.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of broken necks, a lot of traumatic brain injury, a lot of other people who get hurt as well. Richard, thanks for the call, and thanks for watching us there on Free Speech TV in Calumet, Michigan. I miss Michigan. We'll be back 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and welcome back. Huh. The term ATV, this is from Sue Nethercutt in our chat room, the term ATV was originally coined to refer to non-straddle-ridden six-wheeled amphibious ATVs, such as the Jigger, produced by the Jigger Corporation, the Amphicat, produced by Mobility Unlimited, Inc., and the Terra Tiger, produced by the Alice Chambler Manufacturing Company in the mid-1960s and early 70s. So, hey, my recollection of my timeline is pretty much spot on. Interesting. Steve in Haymarket, listening on Sirius. Hey, Steve, what's up?
I was wondering if you'd read Dr. Timothy Ball's new book, The Deliberate Corruption of Climate Science. He's actually a climate scientist, and they're like, unlike Michael Mann, who is not a climate scientist, he's a geologist. And Hansen is not a climate science. He's an astronomer. So I was wondering if you'd read that book yet.
I have not.
Yeah, I'm about third of the way through it. It doesn't look too good for the corruptors of climate science.
Well, I hope you're right, Steve. I hope that it's all nonsense. I hope that these mile-wide tornadoes and storms like Hurricane Sandy are just weird anomalies. I hope that typhoons like the one that just took out large chunks of the Philippines, you know, worst ever, that they're just weird. I hope that, you know, these droughts that we're having across the Midwest, which, you know, we had in the 30s too. I hope that it's just a natural cycle, and that the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil and the scientists that they pay and this guy who wrote the book that you're promoting, The Deliberate Corruption of Climate Scientists, science, you know, I hope they're all right, because I would like to believe that the world will be in, you know, reasonably habitable shape for human beings, you know, in the days of, if I ever have grandchildren, of my grandchildren's generation. I don't think that it's true, but I would love to believe that. And I think most Americans would love to believe it. Steve, thanks for the call. Zed in Seattle. Hey, Zed, what's up?
Oh, I was just liking to point out the fact that you were saying that horses were okay to walk through burial grounds, native burial
well,
grounds.
Well, no, they're not, and they're okay to walk through. This is a fairly large region. It's tens of thousands or thousands of acres. There is a burial ground in there, and what I was saying is that the federal government, there are still off-site areas. You know, you can't go through there at all. The burial ground, the ruins. But in the area around them, you're also the only way that you can go through there is by horseback under BLM regulation, and even that is pretty dicey. In some places they regulate that fairly tightly to limit the number of people on horseback because they don't want so much damage done. But what were you going to say?
Well, I grew up in northwest Montana, and my grandfather flew
small airplanes for the fish and game. They had all mm-hmm. kinds of animals tagged, from lingcod to grizzly bear and everything in between. And he said he was flying through the Bob Marshall Wilderness, and he said there were like five or six ruts wide, and he wasn't sure what they were. He turned to the guy from the fish and game. The guy pointed out that those were horse tracks, and what they do is they'll run them in one straight path until the horses start dragging their stomachs on the ground, and then they'll move them over to the next track, and they just keep digging these huge ruts, and it's just totally destroying a lot of the land.
Who's the they who's running the horses?
You mean
wolves, or do you mean people?
No, people. Human beings that are.
Oh, you mean they're riding the horses?
Yeah, and they're using them to pack in supplies and stuff like that, too.
Oh. Huh.
And my grandpa was blown away by how much devastation just horses, you know, just pack animals.
Well, I keep, you know, every time I say
like
horses.
There were no horses in North America until the Spanish brought them over.
Right. Well, and I pointed that out, and then people call up and go, oh, no, you can go back 30,000 years ago and find horse, you know, remains. And I say, yeah, but those horses were only as big as large dogs. And they say, but still they're horses. So you can't say they're not indigenous. And I'm sure somebody will call and argue that with me again. But the level of horses, it's the hoofed animals that were, you know, like the bison and the buffalo, that were widespread across those regions. And those animals, because instead of having flat feet like horses do, they have hoofs. The hoofs dig into the ground. So what they're essentially doing as they're walking is they're puncturing the soil and aerating it and cycling it, as opposed to tamping it down and hardening it, and which is the difference, how horses can damage land that bison actually resurrect. And there's a really good video on this, on how, you know, our grasslands need to come back. And I'm forgetting the guy's name who did it, but it went pretty viral. He was making some exaggerated claims about, you know, what it could all be and what it could all be done. But excellent point. Zed, thanks a lot for the call. Rick in Muskogee, Oklahoma. Hey, Rick, how you doing?
Fine, Tommy. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
Hey, we were talking the other day about the right to travel.
Yes, sir.
You remember?
I do.
Okay, yeah, you were concerned I may be.
Yeah, you were saying people shouldn't have to have driver's licenses to drive cars.
No, I was saying they don't. Many Americans don't have to have a driver's license.
Right.
And this has been fought in the Supreme Court for a long, long time. In fact,
right.
Let me read for you from Thompson versus Smith.
Okay.
Okay. The right of the citizen to travel upon public highways and to transport his property thereon in the ordinary course of life and business is a common right which he has under the right to enjoy life, liberty, to acquire and possess property, and to pursue happiness and safety. He includes the right in doing so to use the ordinary and usual conveyances of the day, and under the existing modes of travel includes the right to drive a horse-drawn carriage, or wagon thereon, or to operate an automobile thereon.
For what year was that passed?
Let's see. Thompson versus Smith.
Because it was in the 19-teens, the 1910s and the 19-teens, that they started licensing people and putting up stop signs. In the 1920s, they started putting up stop lights in a green on red, yellow, green. So
right.
I'm guessing this
and
preceded
they
that?
It. Yeah, they can regulate it in traffic speeds, stop signs, and that sort of thing.
Right.
But they cannot issue a license and a fee for the right to travel.
Okay. Again, what year was that?
Having trouble finding that.
Okay.
There are counts.
All right. Well, you're going to have to call me back, Rick, and let me know because we're out of time. But I'm guessing it was pre-1915 anyway. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. And Brendan Hammy is, am I saying that right? Brendan?
Hey.
Hey.
Hi, Tom. Pleasure to be with you.
Great to have you with us. H-A-M-M-E, is the E pronounced? Is it Hammy?
Yeah, that's right.
Great. You are the staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California, ACLUSOCAL.org, as in ACLU SoCal, or Southern California. And I find this fascinating. Apparently there's a ballot measure, or is this a legislative measure about bullying?
Well, it's a measure that's being brought by the City Council of Carson.
Oh, okay. Great. So tell me about
it. It would be an ordinance.
So it'd be an ordinance. Tell me about it.
Well, so the ordinance will create criminal penalties for bullying conduct. Now, we at the ACLU certainly understand where the Carson City Council is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no doubt in our minds that bullying is a pervasive problem that's deserving of our attention. You know, it negatively impacts far too many of our most vulnerable populations of youth. But we believe that criminalization of bullying is not the right approach to addressing the issue.
So, and I think that to amplify somewhat on what you just said, we know that the most at-risk kids for suicide are gay pre-adolescents and just adolescents, young gay people,
mm-hmm.
and that one of the principal reasons why they're the most at risk for suicide is not just being conflicted over their sexuality, but because they're being bullied. And then there are, you know, obviously other groups as well that are at high risk of suicide, which is tightly associated with being bullied. And then occasionally somebody snaps because they've been bullied, and now you've got, you know, Eric Klebold. And so we don't want bullying to happen. And then we also know that people who bully in school tend to end up being, you know, executives in companies that bully people. Or what, I mean, it just carries over into their lives. They become spouse abusers, everything else. So we really want to snap this or stop this stuff and nip this in the bud, I guess, is the cliche I was looking for. So what do we do about it?
Definitely.
So what do we do about it?
Well, so there are far better approaches to dealing with the bullying problems that we see than criminalization. So there are, you know, school districts throughout California are using positive behavioral interventions and supports in which positive student behavior is rewarded and misbehaviors are addressed in a constructive way. They're also using programs like restorative justice where, you know, in which a student who has been bullied and the student who has done the bullying can be brought together in a way where they're really healing the wounds that exist between them and getting to the root causes of the problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, criminalization is not going to do any of that.
In fact, is this not in some ways symptomatic of a larger kind of knee-jerk reaction in America that might be some small part of the answer to the question, why is it that America, with one-third the population of China, has almost twice as many people in prison, that we just, our reaction to anything is to criminalize it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that you're absolutely right. And we see this with zero-tolerance policies. So zero-tolerance policies were put into place, well, really in response to the war on drugs and other tough-on-crime initiatives. But we've seen them employed increasingly to combat bullying of students. But what we find is that those responses, those punitive disciplinary measures, actually are employed far more frequently against the very students they're designed to protect. So against students of color, students with disabilities, and LGBT students.
Right. So what would your what are you saying to the city council that's considering this? And by the way, is this something that is this the first time this kind of thing has popped up? I'm guessing that this is symptomatic of things that have happened elsewhere.
Sure. So, I mean, I think that there are a couple of somewhat similar laws that were enacted elsewhere in the country. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, this would be the first type of law that would be, if it were to be enacted, would be the first of its type within this state.
That is just so insanely broad, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, our concern is that the law is vague and overbroad. Mm-hmm. It defines harassment as conduct that would cause a person to feel terrorized, frightened, intimidated, threatened, harassed, or molested, and which serves no legitimate purpose. But it doesn't actually define what constitutes a legitimate purpose. Right. It doesn't require that the conduct be offensive to a reasonable person. Creating the opportunity for criminalization of minor behavior.
Well, doesn't law? I mean, isn't that one of the basic tenets of law that you can't that everything has to pass the reasonable person test? Or am I? You know, I'm not a law school graduate. Am I missing something here?
No, I mean it's certainly a very key component of many of our laws.
Okay, but it's not necessarily written into those laws. It's simply that's part of how you adjudicate something, or is it typically written into a law?
Well, the reasonableness standard is typically written into the law.
Okay. All right.
But, you know, it also defines bullying as including cyberbullying, which, according to the city council, includes sending hurtful, rude, and mean text messages. So, you know, it's easy to see kind of just how much everyday behavior could potentially be criminalized by a law like this.
Right. And the flip side of this, too, and, going back to my thing about the hyper-criminalization of everything in our society, I suspect that the city council members may not realize how much incredible lifelong damage is done to somebody by having a criminal record, that may be far worse than even being bullied.
Oh, yeah, no, most definitely. We think that the law is going to fuel the school-to-prison pipeline by charging youth with crimes rather than addressing the root causes of the conduct. And those contacts with the criminal justice system absolutely have lasting negative repercussions for that student's life going forward. Difficulties getting jobs, getting into institutions of higher education, students who have had contacts with the criminal justice system are far more likely to have future contacts with the system and to drop out of school entirely.
Yeah, yeah. And so how do you think this is going? Is the council person who's promoting this listening to you?
Well, I certainly hope so. I guess that we'll have to see that on, I believe they're reconsidering it on the 20th.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And who is aggressively promoting this, other than somebody who thought it was a good idea and decided to put it before the city council?
You know, I honestly don't know. My apologies.
So, well, but in other words, there's not like, you know, the Koch brothers and Alec behind it or something like that.
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay, well, that's reassuring. Brendan, thanks a lot for dropping by and for your insights into this.
No, thank you for having me.
Sure. Brendan Hammy, and he's with the ACLU of Southern California. ACLUSocal.org is the website, and I truly appreciate it. It's a fascinating topic. Thank you. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, got a minute to the break. It's yours. What's up?
Oh, great. How you doing, Tom? I just wanted to say that as far as Bundy is concerned.
Yeah, back to Cliven.
Exactly. And anyone else that says they don't respect the federal government, I can go back in the history. Ever since we had the Declaration of Independence and we got our independence, I don't think we had this much dissent as far as building trust in the government. But I think, all of this stems from the Civil War.
Yeah. And well, actually,
right back to slavery.
You know, yeah, it does. I really believe it does all go back to slavery. If you read Patrick Henry's speech to the Virginia Ratifying Convention, in which he was the largest slaveholder in the state of Virginia, and he was advocating for the Second Amendment because he was saying that individual state militias, which back then were called slave patrols in the southern states, that without these things, that the white people were outnumbered by their slaves and there could be slaughter, and that you know, we had to hold back the federal government. And I think that original sin of slavery has been the cleaving factor throughout the history of America, and I agree with you. I think that this goes right back to that. Charles, thanks a lot for the call. Great. great to hear from you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And more of the news of the day, my thoughts on it, and your thoughts on my thoughts right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jeannie in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, you are on the air. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system.
Thank you. The nice young lady who answered the phone informed me that you guys haven't been able to find out if Bundy is receiving Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid.
That's correct, and because our national press, who has been able to get through to and interview him, and the right-wing press that he's been hanging out with, I don't think they want to know the answer to the question.
Well, why don't you put your TV audience, radio audience, I'll bet you there's a lot of young people out there who would be able to find out by searching websites and stuff.
Sure. Well, if anybody can find out if Cliven Bundy's getting Social Security or Medicare, call us up and let us know.
Was he a veteran? Did he fight in any of our wars?
Again, I don't know. I don't know that story. Although I'm guessing that piece of his personal biography is probably out there. I mean, his life has been fairly well looked into by now. But I honestly, I don't know the answer. I'm more concerned with, I'm not as concerned with Cliven Bundy himself and whether or not he's a hypocrite or an idiot or a misguided, you know, good soul who's misguided. I'm not so concerned with those things as I am with this whole group of folks who are peddling this idea that the government of the United States is not legitimate, that we should not be respecting or honoring it, that we should therefore not participate with it, that, you know, we need not even bother voting, that only county governments have consequence. I mean, these are basically old white supremacist ideas that were used in minority white states in the South to fight back against during Reconstruction to try to reestablish white rule over those states. And they did. They succeeded in doing this. By the end of the 1880s, basically all of the Southern states, which were majority black, were once again under the control of white people, where there had been a brief period, a decade or so. And who was it? Who did Birth of a Nation, the movement? I forget. Anyway, but Birth of the Nation, this movie that came out in 1910 or something like that, which became the major recruiting tool for the KKK throughout the years after that. You know, basically the essence. Yeah, it was D.W. Griffith's movie. It was the first full-length, feature-length silent talkie. And it was this huge recruiting tool for the KKK, and I've watched the movie. It's really worth watching if you really want to understand how racism got peddled in the United States in the early part of the 20th century. And when African Americans took over the South Carolina or North Carolina legislature in the 1870s, right after, late 1860s, early 1870s, right after the Civil War, and in the movie, you know, they're showing up in far field clothes and putting their bare feet up on the desks and acting like idiots, basically. And I frankly seriously doubt that any of that is historically accurate in terms of how people behaved. A, that they took it very seriously who they were. But B, that was the narrative story, was look out, these folks are going to take over everything. And thus the whole pushback that Cliven Bundy is a part of. Jeannie, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. And Kevin in Ocala, Florida, you wanted to get right to the topic of bullying. Good on you. What's up?
Yeah, I was just wanted to touch base a little bit on the conversation you had with Brandon. I think it's ridiculous to actually make bullying a criminal offense as a convicted felon who's done some time in the Florida prison. Mm-hmm. Not something I'm proud of, but I've seen some of the things that go on in there. I was in a youthful offender program, and when I see some of these juveniles in there, 15, 16, 17, looking at 40 years, they're doing time for some minor offenses. Some of them were doing some time for minor offenses, but it turned them into even worse criminals than they were before they even were put into the system. And I think it's not fair to these children if you don't actually attack the problem at its root and do some kind of interventions or have some kind of programs at the school to deal with these bullying issues. I don't think you should, you know, put them into the criminal system and label them as criminals like, some of the other worst people in our society.
Yeah, I'm with you. Our instinct to criminalize things, from Nixon's war on drugs to, well, pretty much everything else, our instinct...
I mean, I just don't think it's fair for those kids, especially when it's the parents' fault. It's a direct result of the lack of parenting and their place in society that leads them to become bullies or become certain people. And
there's a variety of factors. There was a kid when I was growing up, when I was in elementary school, who I had to walk past his house to get to school. And his name was Dennis. And Dennis used to just beat the crap out of me. I mean, you know, he probably did it 30, 40 times. You know, he would chase me down and get me on the ground and just beat me up. And I was scared to death of this guy. And over the years, Dennis lived down the street from us, and I went to that school for about 5 years, maybe 4 years. And over the years, I got to know Dennis a little better. And we actually, toward the end, toward around fifth or sixth grade, we actually sort of became friends. Dennis invited me over to his house once, and we were watching big time wrestling on TV, he and I and a couple of other kids. And his dad came in, and his dad was drunk. And Dennis said something, and his dad took offense to it. And his dad, in front of us, his dad dragged Dennis down into the basement. I mean, we didn't go down to the basement. We just left the house. But he dragged Dennis down to the basement, tied him to a pole, and whipped him with a belt. And that's when I realized why Dennis was the way he was. I mean, you know, he was very wounded. I mean, we were 10 years old, and this is a very wounded kid. So I think that when we look at bullying, this should be considered a medical problem. This is something that, you know, should require the intervention of social services and you know, trained social workers and psychologists, not cops with guns and billy clubs. And the place to put these kids, if necessary, is a foster home, not a group home or something like that, not a prison. So, Kevin, well said. Do you disagree with me, by the way?
I'm sorry?
Would you disagree with that sentiment?
Oh, no, not at all. I actually, I've been a ward of the state as a child when I was growing up. I've been in group homes, foster homes, so I know the results of those things and how children can turn out. However, in a lot of situations, a lot of circumstances, there are a lot better situations than being with the original parents.
Yeah.
Because there have been some abusive parents that I've come across. And I always think to myself that these children deserve, you know, a better family. And sometimes the state can provide better families for those kids.
Yeah, tragically, it's true. Kevin, thank you very much for the call. And thanks for sharing your story with us. Joe, in Lake Elsinore, California, you have an amazing story about a local paper talking about wind farms.
This is Edward from Vancouver, Washington. He writes to this periodical that comes out in the paper. And the question was, does wind farms affect weather, at least locally?
Mm-hmm.
Maryland writes, yes, more widespread than they become, the more these changes will go beyond the immediate effects of the area. Some effects are ground warming, drying for miles around, and they already know that. But circulating effects on the weather, especially if wind farming grows significantly, are unpredictable. One point to note is that while wind farms are a source of renewable energy, it doesn't mean they and other forms of renewable energy, for that matter, don't cause change. Even improved engineering of the turbines to reduce turbulence, etc., cannot eliminate the fact that the machines remove energy from the wind, and this will have an impact on the weather and ultimately the climate. Now, when I read that, I said, that does not sound like the Marilyn that I read. Normally, she's a very intelligent lady, gives a lot of advice, but it sounded like somebody paid her to write that, because it doesn't make any sense to me. I mean,
part, that's totally bizarre. I mean, I can see where extracting a certain amount of energy from the wind might you know, make the wind downstream, downwind, be a little less rough or violent, which would probably be a good thing. But change the climate? Really?
Well, we're already changing it, so this is a better change than the change we're currently getting.
I know, and we're trading this in for an oil-fired power plant that's blowing all kinds of heat into the climate and into the local rivers, or a nuclear power plant that's blowing all kinds of waste heat out. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, that's absolutely incredible. So did you contact her?
The little things like that, that you know, that you see in the paper that kind of fuel this fire that the people that don't want.
Yeah, and they're trying to say, you know, global climate change isn't caused by the Koch brothers refineries. It's caused by wind farms. Oh, my God. So did you contact the author of this, Joe?
I haven't yet. I just read it, and I was discussing it with my wife, and I was just saying, you know, this is ridiculous because we've had quite a bit of wind farming in this area that I've lived in. It's been very, very productive. The electricity costs have come down with solar power. There's some real, as you were telling me about that island, there's some real possibilities here, and I just think that the deniers, these
yeah.
are changing.
I think so, too.
Climate in Washington.
Well, if you have any success in finding out what the origin of that was, where it came from, give us a shout and let us know, okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Joe. I appreciate the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We will be back. It is 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And don't forget, our Twitter account is Tom_Hartman, at, of course, or hashtag, rather, and, or at, yeah. And our Facebook is Tom_Hartman. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very audaciously ugly. The good. The St. Louis Rams. On Saturday evening, the NFL team made history by drafting University of Missouri defensive end Michael Sam, the 249th selection in the draft. When Sam suits up next year for the Rams, he will become the first openly gay player in NFL history. By the way, here's an interesting piece of historical trivia. The Rams now have the honor of being both the first NFL team to integrate by race and the first team to integrate by gender preference. Good on them for keeping their trailblazing ways alive in the 21st century. The bad. Jack Berkman, the D.C. lobbyist who I've debated before on this show, announced before the NFL draft started that he would lead a massive boycott of any team that drafted Michael Sam. Berkman said that the NFL, like most of the rest of American business, is about to learn that when you trample the Christian community and Christian values, there will be a terrible price to pay. Those are strong words, but so far Berkman's boycott seems like an empty threat. Michael Sam's jersey already ranks number 2 in overall rookie jersey sales, just behind the jersey of Cleveland Browns draft pick Johnny Manziel. And the very, very ugly, Derek Ward. While the reaction around the league and the sports world to Michael Sam's draft selection has been overwhelmingly positive, Ward, a former running back for the New York Giants and Houston Texans, can't get over his own homophobia. Right after Sam was drafted, he sent out a bunch of tweets complaining about Sam's kissing his boyfriend on TV. Ward said, "I'm sorry, but that Michael Sam is no bueno for doing that on national TV. I'm fine with it being a new day and age, but for him to do that on national TV is disgusting. Man, you got little kids looking at the draft. I can't believe ESPN even allowed that to happen." End of quote. If Derek Ward were really concerned about what the children see on TV and on the computer, he'd stop being so publicly homophobic. But he was just too blinded by his own ignorance to see Michael Sam's kiss for what it was, a great moment for sports fans of all identities, gay, straight, or anywhere in between. The fact that Ward apparently can't see that is not only sad, it's very, very ugly. It's the very, very ugly. So I'm trying to find, I'm looking over at Bernie.org, and I don't see it there. Sanders.senate.gov. Let me check this out. Because I know some folks from Vermont are heading over. I'm guessing if you're on his email list that you can find it, but I'm going to have to figure out how to get people to it. But Bernie on this Saturday at 6:30 p.m. is going to be speaking at the in Goose Lake, Iowa. is going to be the keynote speaker at the annual Clinton County Democratic Hall of Fame dinner. And so one of those websites, I'll find out and I'll get back to you on this. But it looks like it's going to be a fun thing. I spent part of the weekend with Bernie. So I'm at breakfast Saturday morning. Flew in late Friday night. And so I'm at breakfast Saturday morning, and then I watched his keynote speech for the Progressive Democrats of America 10th anniversary, and it was just brilliant. I mean, Bernie does it right, does it well, knows the issues. So it was fascinating. So Cindy on WCPT, you were a bully from Chicago?
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Yes, I was a bully. I grew up in a home with verbal, physical abuse, as long as molestation by my stepfather.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was the verbal, physical abuser. If other people in our community, even at school, would have possibly taken the time to look at the signs of why I was acting out and doing the things I was doing, the torture of all that could have went away a lot earlier.
Yeah.
Instead of much later on in life, at almost the age of 40, did I finally start to go to counseling after my stepfather had passed away. That this one person was then not there to make me feel like I did something wrong.
Right. So you're almost telling my friend Dennis's story, or my bully Dennis's story, from that perspective. And I've often wondered whatever happened to him. I have a feeling that he didn't, he's my age, he'd be 63 now. And I have a feeling that he did not have a happy life, and it may even have ended short given the way he behaved. And I know that, you know, as when we became teenagers, we ended up going to different schools, and, but I didn't keep track of him, but, you know, I occasionally run across his name. And he was the one who was into fast cars and fast women and a lot of drinking and basically getting in trouble with the law. So it wouldn't surprise me if he spent probably half his life in jail. I mean, God only knows. And it's just a sad, sad thing. I just remember that day his dad took him down to the basement to whip him with his belt. And I'm thinking, oh, my God.
That brings tears to my eyes now, that if people just weren't so ashamed sometimes of what they see in their own house. And I had brothers and sisters and many aunts and uncles who kept their mouths shut, wouldn't say anything. But as a child, you don't go against your parents.
Yeah.
You're told, keep it a secret. You do.
Yeah. So bullying very often is a symptom of psychological or physical abuse, and something that, or arguably even sexual abuse, and something that needs to be, again, this is, you know, we use the blunt instrument of the criminal justice system for so many things. Addiction, for example, that should be dealt with our medical system or our social welfare systems. Cindy, thank you for sharing your story with us.
I appreciate your time, Tom.
Thank you. I know it probably was not easy. Thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
It's a Bundy thing. There's a name that came up that I hadn't heard in years called Posse Comitatus.
Yeah.
A group. Now.
No, it's not a group. It's a name. It's a law. There was a law passed.
It's an actual group.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
I ran into a fellow from Missouri when I was in the Air Force back in 1980.
Yeah.
His father and brother were in prison for murder. Because when the revenuers, the IRS, would come around to tell them they owed taxes, Posse Comitatus was whacking them in the head and burying them with a backhoe.
Whoa!
Yeah, so the moral of that story is never argue with a farmer that owns a backhoe.
that is one moral. Yeah, what's really interesting to me, and I only learned this in the last year, and I thought I knew a fair amount about American history, but you know, most of my knowledge of American history is limited to the period from roughly 1860 to 1920 or 1820, and then the modern, you know, the FDR era. So I didn't know that much about the Civil War era and Reconstruction, and I recently learned that the Posse Comitatus Law, which was passed in the 1870s, and 1876, as I recall, which says that the federal government shall not send troops into the states to perform police functions, that the reason that was passed was it was pushed through by Southern senators who were sick and tired of having the Northern Army of Occupation occupy the South and enforce federal law, things like the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment that allowed black people to vote and gave them rights. And so they wanted to get this federal occupying force out of the Southern states, and the Posse Comitatus law was to do that so that those states could go back to or could go into what became known as Jim Crow. And nowadays, you know, and thus the Posse Comitatus law was repealed a few years ago, and I think it's been put back on the books. However, after something like Kent State, it seems like a good idea, or, you know, looking at any other government around the world where the federal military turns its guns on its own people. I mean, look at what's going on in Egypt right now. It seems like having something like the Posse Comitatus Act in place is a good idea. As to the group, the Posse Comitatus, yeah, there's a bunch of these white supremacist, right wing, don't respect the existence of the federal government. It's all tyranny, damn it. The county sheriffs are the ultimate authority. A bunch of these groups around, a bunch of these people around, and they have been responsible for killing more people since 9/11 than Muslim terrorists have. And the FBI is only beginning, I think, to take them seriously. And, you know, time will tell how this all shakes out. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. By the way, just Shane shared this with me. Steve from Virginia called in the last hour, and he said, hey, have you heard about this book about the BS of the science of climate change? And he says, I'm about a third of the way through it, and et cetera. It turns out that this book was written by a guy, Timothy Ball, climate denier, and he was funded by a group called the Friends of Science, and the Friends of Science is a Canadian nonprofit advocacy group based in Calgary, Alberta, that is funded by the fossil fuel industry. Surprise, surprise. There was one other call that we got that we were going to debunk on the air. I forgot what it was. Oh, yeah, the guy who says he said the Supreme Court says you don't need a driver's license. Shane looked that one up during the break. Bless you, Shano. And it's great to have a producer who's smarter than I am. And Shane looked that one up, and what he discovered was that it wasn't the U.S. Supreme Court. It was the Virginia Supreme Court. And basically what it was saying was that local police officers, local authorities, were overusing their authority to revoke people's driver's licenses. And you can't do that. People have a right to have a driver's license, assuming that they can meet the standards established by the state. So you can't be arbitrary and capricious, basically, in revoking people's driver's licenses, which makes perfect sense, and it doesn't mean that anybody can drive anywhere without a driver's license.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
All this is why Shane graduated law school and I didn't. Bless you, brother. We'll be back. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour, I was just telling Shane, when we lived in, we had just left the Committee for Abused Kids. We were living in Atlanta. And I was making a living writing for magazines. I was contributing editor to 7 different Ziff Davis magazines. And so I was working from home. And Louise and I had started a travel agency. And at that point, Louise was running the travel agency, and I was a stay-at-home dad. And I discovered that you can stand for the bar in D.C. and the federal bar and in California without being a graduate of an accredited law school. And there was an online unaccredited law school that said, you know, it was like back of the matchbook cover. And it was like, if you pass our test, you know, if you can pass our school, and it was basically teach to the test. If you pass our school, you will be able to take and successfully pass the federal bar exam. And I spent 5-6 months, you know, reading their stuff and going through it and thinking, you know, this is cool. It'd be fun to be a lawyer. But then it became so tedious. There was so much stuff. I mean, you know, especially when it got into real estate law and it got into, I just reached a point where I was just tilt, you know. I was never designed to be a lawyer, and it ain't going to happen. So I guess I have to be happy with my honorary PhD from Goddard. Sheldon in Peoria, Illinois, watching Free Speech TV on the Direct TV satellite. Hey, Sheldon, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how are you today?
Great. What's up?
You've changed topics a couple of times.
I have. Feel free to pick one.
Yeah, the global warming thing.
Uh-huh.
All these senators who asked for no benefit to be given to, like, Hurricane Sandy victims or Katrina victims or Isaiah victims, they're the same senators going to come back and ask for some type of assistance. Oklahoma, Inhofe in Oklahoma, they're going to come back and ask for those same benefits, first of all. And if they don't understand what's happening in their districts, then they're just not paying attention. Global warming is here.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in Illinois. I'm in Peoria, Illinois. And we have had two wind farms put up within 50 miles. Mm-hmm. And it has helped tremendously, not to Peoria, Illinois, but to the concerning communities around. And if there were more wind farms, I was so happy.
Because the wind farms diminish the velocity of the wind, so the storms aren't as bad on you?
No, it didn't diminish the wind, but at least enhanced the amount of energy we have.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, yeah. I mean, it's nothing we can do about the winds unless we do something about climate change.
Right.
But I just felt that, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things out there that we really don't have control over.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, though. There's this, apparently it's kind of like an Ask Somebody column in Parade Magazine. The link was in our chat room. And, by the way, a great place to learn things and meet some of the finest minds on Earth. And I'm looking for it. I think it's scrolled off now. But it was in our chat room about, you know, how wind farms are actually changing the climate. Apparently not. So, anyhow, Sheldon, final point, 10 seconds.
I love the part that you did about the solar farm.
Okay. Thank you very much. Sheldon, thanks for watching Free Speech TV in Peoria, Illinois. We will be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and the effort to free America's political prisoner, Governor Don Siegelman, free-don.org. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
A great deal. Islamist militants Boko Haram have released a video apparently showing about 130 girls kidnapped from a school in northern Nigeria on the 14th of April. He said that the children would be held until all imprisoned militants had been freed. Now, the girls are pictured wearing full hijab and speaking. Some of them are speaking in the video. They appear to be praying. He says that they have all converted to Islam. Now, he said also that his offer to swap the girls for imprisoned militants only referred to the children who had not converted to Islam. It's thought the majority of the girls are Christian, but some of the girls are Muslim because the area that they come from is mixed Christians and Muslims. Now, the Nigerian leadership has already said that they've rejected the deal, telling the BBC that it was absurd for a terrorist group to try to set conditions. And that's risky because, obviously the standard thing is you don't negotiate with terrorists, but it is risky because if all the girls do eventually end up dead, they're going to take even more flack for not having negotiated with the terrorists.
Yeah.
Meantime, on a strange political note, former Representative Alan West, Republican of Florida, has argued today that are we witnessing an Obama wag the dog moment with Boko Haram in Nigeria? I say yes.
Boko Haram did this so that we could stop talking about Benghazi?
No, not quite, actually. But that the Obamas are talking about it, creating the straw man of Boko Haram, another distraction for which no real action will take place. anyone remember Joseph Kony?
Who's Joseph Kony?
You know Joseph Kony.
Joseph Kony. I'm sorry. Joseph yeah, Kony, the Ugandan warlord.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
That was a Wag the Dog operation, too?
Apparently so. They're very busy wagging dogs.
Yes, yes, all the time, all the time.
All the time.
Yeah, I remember, you know, the last big one that I remember was when Bill Clinton, in the last year of his presidency, when he was being prosecuted, maybe the year before last, when he was being prosecuted in the Senate, I think it had moved into the Senate. He had already been impeached, and the prosecution was going on for his dalliance, for his lying about his dalliance with Monica. And he threw three missiles into Afghanistan, into an al-Qaeda camp to try to kill Osama bin Laden. This was either 99 or 2000. And on the floor of the Senate, maybe it was the House, but I think it was the Senate, floor of the Senate, one of these guys got up and said, he's just trying to wag the dog. This is classic wag the dog stuff. Clinton's just trying to distract us. We have no business throwing missiles into Afghanistan. Bin Laden's no threat. I wish I had the tape of that.
Oh, that would be a dream.
Yeah, but I remember it as if it was yesterday, and Sandy Berger reminded me of it. We had him on this program maybe, I don't know, 5 years ago, and he said that when the transition happened, and he met with Condi Rice, and he knew that Al Gore met with Joe Biden and that Clinton met with Bush, not with Al Biden, who was with Cheney. Al Gore met with Cheney. And anyhow, they all met with their successors. And he said, I told personally Condi Rice that the number one challenge she was going to face was Osama bin Laden. And I know that the vice president and the president also told their respective successors that that was going to be the number one challenge. And we were all basically laughed at. And they decided anything that Bill Clinton was worried about was something that we should not be worried about. And they went off in different directions.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyhow, back to you.
That's astonishing. Wow. The White House said today that the U.S. will not recognize the results of weekend autonomy referenda in two regions of eastern Ukraine, blasting the votes as illegal under Ukrainian law. Press Secretary Jay Carney said the referenda were a transparent attempt to create further division and disorder, and he noted media reports documenting carousel voting, pre-marked ballots, children casting votes, and the announcement of results before ballots could be counted.
Yeah, let's keep in mind, too, though, that this was not an actual vote to do anything. This was a kind of sense of the people vote. It had no
right.
binding. It had no legal whatever.
Right. However, a self-declared Donetsk People's Republic leader, Denis Pushilin, today is now calling on Russia to absorb the eastern region of Donetsk after Sunday's referendum, urging Moscow to listen to the will of the people.
Yeah. My prediction is that within a year that's going to happen, but I'm just pulling that out of my left ear. I'm just guessing.
Good. There will be a vote in the Senate around 5:30 p.m. Eastern today on whether to end debate on an energy efficiency bill, which is bipartisan, hugely popular, and which will likely fail. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid today blasted Republicans for holding what he called hostage the bill. He said Republican demands for votes on five amendments to the bill threaten to prevent the Senate from functioning. What's the big issue? The Keystone XL pipeline.
Oh, yeah.
He is offering to allow a vote on legislation to authorize the construction of the pipeline if the Senate passes the energy efficiency bill from Senators Gene Shaheen and Rob Portman. But Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has said his caucus won't see the filibuster unless the GOP gets votes on at least five amendments. Reid says Republicans keep changing the goalposts for an agreement on passing the bill, and so the bill will go down for a second time.
Here's what I think is going on. You know, there was a Pew poll a while back that found that more than 60% of Americans cannot name which party controls the House or the Senate. So, but more than 85% of Americans know that the president is a Democrat. So if the Republicans can continue to do damage and prevent any kind of forward progress in the House and the Senate, knowing that most people won't realize it was the Republicans, but knowing that a Democrat's in the White House, the Democrats will get blamed for it in 2014, and that's the Republican strategy, in my opinion. But anyhow, Victoria, thank you for your news report.
Thank you so much.
Good talking with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 5 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, we've covered a lot of territory today. We haven't talked about the 13 Benghazis that occurred on Bush's watch without a peep from Fox News. There is, however, I wanted to share some science with you. We talked about, by the way, if you're in anywhere near Clinton County, Iowa, and I've heard actually that some folks are carpooling from Chicago area over to hear Bernie at the annual Clinton County Democratic Hall of Fame dinner in Goose Lake, Iowa. And friends of Bernie Sanders sent me this email. And there's a link on it, but it's to something else. So I'm going to try and get you. I don't know if it's Bernie.org or whatever, but it's going to be this Saturday. Senator Sanders will be there. I just, you know, I'm telling you that because I heard Bernie speak Saturday at the PDA meeting, and it was the first time I've heard Bernie speak in a public venue in years. I mean, you know, I used to hear him speak when he was my congressman when I lived in Vermont, and I hear him speak every week on the radio here. But he gave a hell of a speech, and he educated people. It was really, really quite impressive. Anyhow, there's a piece of science that I wanted to share with you. And we've talked about Clive and Budney. We've talked about the ugly American. You know, we've talked about bullying. We had an interesting conversation with a fellow from the ACLU who says that bullying should not be dealt with legally, but rather, you know, instead of criminalizing it, we should medicalize it. And my word's not his, but I totally agree with that. I think that the same thing is true of our drug laws. They're crazy. If somebody is a drug addict, that is not a criminal condition. It's a medical condition. But here's a fascinating thing. This is in the current issue of Science. ScienceMag.org is the website, although I think that you have to be a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science to read the whole article, which I am. And so I have the whole article here. I'll share pieces of it with you. Although the abstract is available for anybody to read. So what they found, well, here this come here's the headline and the abstract. The headline is large-scale psychological differences within China explained by rice versus wheat culture. Some parts of China, principally North China, they grow wheat. Other parts of China, Central and South China, they grow principally rice, although in Central China they grow both. Most Chinese restaurants, if you walk into a Chinese restaurant in America today, you're going to get Northern Chinese food. And the soy sauce isn't actually made out of soybeans, it's made out of fermented wheat, which is why I can't eat it. And I'm real conscious of this because I walk into these restaurants and they thicken their sauces with wheat flour. And the soy sauce is wheat, and I would get so sick in most Chinese restaurants. And every now and then I'll find a Chinese restaurant that's a southern Chinese restaurant, and they have soy sauce that's actually made out of soy, or they use fish sauce or something like that, and they will have food that is thickened with rice rather than wheat, but whatever. What they found was that there's actually a psychological difference between people who live in wheat-growing areas and people who live in rice-growing areas. So the question was, why? And what's the difference? Well, first of all, the difference is that the rice-growing people, and this is at the level of individual psychology. I mean, it also happens across culture, but at the level of individual psychology, the rice-growing people tend to be more cooperative, more collaborative, more empathetic, more community-based. They're like liberals. All for one, one for all. We're all in this together. Whereas in the wheat-growing areas, they tend to be more libertarian, less empathetic, less willing to help their neighbors, more, I got mine, you know, good luck on you, Charlie. Less interdependent and more independent. And so the question was, why? Is this a matter of genetics? Is it a matter of climate? Or does it have something to do, is it a matter of how the food affects people's brains? Turns out it's none of those three things. This is absolutely fascinating. The abstract, they say cross-cultural psychologists have mostly contrasted East Asia with the West. However, this study shows that there are major psychological differences within China. Within China, not, you know, China versus the West like us, but within China itself. We propose that a history of farming rice makes cultures more interdependent, whereas farming wheat makes cultures more independent. And these agricultural legacies continue to affect people in the modern world. We tested 1,162 Han Chinese participants in six sites and found that rice-growing southern China is more interdependent and holistic thinking than the wheat-growing north. To control for confounds, like, in other words, things that could actually be what's going on, but or it might even seem like it's what's going on, but it isn't. To control for confounds like climate, we tested people from neighboring counties along the rice-wheat border and found differences that were just as large. In other words, climate had nothing to do with it. We also found that modernization and pathogen prevalence theories, in other words, is it that they have different bugs, different bacteria, their bodies are reacting differently to the food, any of these things, or just modern culture. We also found that modernization and pathogen prevalence theories do not fit the data. So why is it that people who live in rice-growing regions of China, psychologically at the individual level, are more communitarian and less libertarian than people who live in the wheat-growing areas? Well, it turns out that if you want to grow wheat, all you have to do is go out and drop some wheat berries in your field and sit and watch it grow, more or less. You can do that all by yourself. If you want to go grow rice, though, rice has to be continuously immersed in water. Rice paddies, remember? And in most places, rice paddies don't just like kind of spontaneously develop along riverside. They're made. And so you have these elaborate aqua engineering, water engineering structures in rice-growing areas where your rice paddy gets water from the rice paddy of the neighbor to your left, and it drains water to the rice paddy of the neighbor to your right. And every spring everybody gets out and they open up all the trenches and they clean out each other's rice paddies. They do it together. And that if you poop in your rice paddy, or you get waste or toxins in your rice paddy, it's going to end up in your neighbor's rice paddy, and he's not going to be happy about that, or vice versa. And if you screw up your rice paddy, you've screwed up, you know, 10, 15, 20 rice paddies down the road, and everybody's upset with you. And so, in other words, rice-growing people, everybody's in it together. They are interdependent. Whereas wheat-growing people, you can do it all by yourself. Everybody can be independent. And this not only translates into a difference in society and culture, but it actually rewires the brains of people who grow up in these societies and culture over time. And I find that fascinating. So what is this? How does this apply to us? Well, for us, our rice growing is our healthcare system. We just went from a wheat-based healthcare system, the Republican conservative, you know, buy it from a health insurance company, good luck, Charlie, to a rice-based healthcare system. We're all in it together, and if we all work well, and if everybody buys in, it'll work for everybody. Same thing with education. We used to have a rice-based education system. That is, everybody pays for the public school, everybody uses it. Now, increasingly, we're moving toward a wheat-based education system.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, the private schools, the charter schools, all that kind of stuff. And in area after area after area, you can see these differences. And I think it's fascinating. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And some folks still want to, you know, are still on the line to talk about things that we were talking about a half hour or an hour ago, which is fine. Diane in San Jose, California, you wanted to talk about bullying? Diane? Watching Free Speech TV? She must be watching her TV instead of listening to her telephone. Karen in Garner, North Carolina. You wanted to talk about bullying. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, my daughter was bullied in school so badly, she ended up wanting to hurt herself.
Mm.
And I took her out of school for 3 weeks to get her therapy, and she went back to school, brought her back into the guidance office to let her know this is a safe place you can talk to. You know, come to get help if you need it. And that's when the social worker walked in and blasted me for having her out of school. She continued to get bullied, got thrown into a locker, and the door was closed on her. The school did not contact me. I took her out of school. Now I have to go to court.
Incredible. It's almost like you got bullied.
Yes, I was traumatized by this so-called social worker. It was... I don't even know how to.
This is bizarre. This is in the North Carolina
public schools. I was bullied myself. Yeah. Wake County public school system. The Koch brothers got their meat hooks in us.
Really? How?
Well, I think they've pretty much replaced all the administration with Tea Party people because they wouldn't even hear what I had to say. I tried to talk to the principal about it. He wouldn't even listen to me.
Wow.
About what happened to my child.
Wow.
I mean, it's crazy. And when my child said she wanted to hurt herself, the social worker said, "You just wanted attention."
Well, A, what child doesn't want attention? But B, sometimes wanting attention can be a cry for help.
Exactly. And I was bullied as a child, and my parents didn't do anything.
Yeah.
And I turned to drinking and drugs. I do not want that for my child.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
And the school, I tried getting her out into a different school, and they would not work with me. No, they want to take me to court. And I'm disabled myself, so.
That's incredible.
I'm back on anti-anxiety medicine. I mean, they're really messing with our lives.
Yeah, I'm so sorry to hear that, Karen.
Thank you.
I have to say, you know, when I was bullied as a kid and I came home crying more than once, my mother and father sat down with me. They took it seriously. They listened to the stories. My father, in particular, was good at reframing it. He made the point over and over again that one time a kid accused me of stealing. My dad said, well, that means that he's a thief. You know, he's judging the world by himself. When Dennis used to beat me up, my dad said, "I'll bet there's something going on that you don't know about in Dennis's life that makes him this way." And it turned out it was true. And it wasn't like, you know, ignore it. And it wasn't like, go out and kick him in the nuts and, you know, fight back. It was like, understand it. And if you understand and don't worry, we're here for you and we have compassion for you. And my father and my mother actually once went to the school and complained about Dennis. And, had I known at the time, and I know that the school went to his parents and said, "Your son is a bully." Had I known at the time what was going on in Dennis's home, my guess is that Dennis just got the crap beat out of him by his father because of the school contacting them. And Dennis was actually worse toward me after that. And so, you know, that was not a good strategy. We stopped that. But I think he is worse toward me because his father is worse toward him. So I'm with you, Karen. It's something that we really need to take seriously, and I'm so sorry to hear that the Tea Party's taken over your school district. I wish you and your daughter the best. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Brad in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Brad, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, my sympathy for the lady who was just on, too, because it's a tough situation when you're dealing with a school administration and they
refuse to take bullying seriously.
I'm at home with my autistic son who was diagnosed as learning disabled, and now I'm homeschooling him because of the bullying that was at the Chicago Public School, and I actually had to take him out of school and become a stay-at-home father and school him here instead of him getting the state mandated education that he's supposed to get. But I also don't think that these laws that they're proposing in California does anything other than empower people that were abusing the lady before. They can have a teacher who's got a child that should be included, who's autistic, but might be in a way that that is annoying, and the school district doesn't want to pay for a full-time paraprofessional, for example,
right,
to keep them in class, and they don't have the infrastructure or the way to actually fulfill their mandate to give these kids the fair education that they're supposed to be getting without full-time paraprofessionals. And it's a big, what ends up happening is school districts end up developing tactics and strategies to eliminate these children through pushing the blame on them. Well, if they're the one that's crying and they're in the fight, well, we're going to make that a behavioral problem. We'll start a behavioral study, and instead of providing them a secure environment that's safe from coercion and harassment through actually having eyes on the child and feet on the ground, they'll force them out using these new laws. And you're taking cops away from looking at real crime and focusing them on a civil matter of coercion, harassment,
yeah,
that, you know, even a guardian ad litem or a lawyer for the children's interests at the school that can intervene on these things, it's got to go a different way, because there are too many families that end up getting torn apart because they're introducing children into school that might have an alternative lifestyle or an alternative, they're included,
neurology.
They're guaranteed this, and it's hard to get people to fulfill their requirements because it's easier to do risk management and just kick them out with these laws and or threats through CPS, Child Protection Services.
Yeah.
You know, you were aghast when the guy was saying that the standard of proof was not even reasonable suspicion, it was probable. What was the term? Well, it's different than Illinois.
It had nothing to do with the reasonable man doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but to make a hotline call and complain about child abuse needs reasonable suspicion in Illinois. And it's not even that. It's unless you're talking about it beaming down from an alien civilization or something that we can easily discount, they're going to move forward. So there's really no due process to start the ball rolling. And then I'm sure you've heard all the horror stories about family courts and the fact that that's an underobserved, there's no sunlight in that administrative process.
Right.
It becomes
theoretically to protect the confidentiality of the child. Yeah.
So I'm against law.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you. Thank you very much for the call, Brad. I appreciate it. Steve in Wilmette, Illinois. Hey, Steve, you wanted to talk about wheat culture and rice culture?
Correct. I found it, first of all, I found the study you were talking about extremely fascinating, and it made sense the way the two different, you know, the social organization around raising the two different crops results in a different outlook. I wonder if that could, now that applies in China, but I wonder if other, because we grow wheat and rice in the United States. I think the rice is in the southeast, maybe
yes,
Louisiana, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And I wonder if the conclusions of the study could be applied to the United States or other places.
I would guess that in the era before factory farming, it could be. But now, you know, since Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in 1983 or 82, and within a generation, within a decade and a half, you had all these small farms just wiped out and replaced by large agribiz, you know, aggregating huge blocks of property. And in many cases, the same farmers working the same land, but now they're renting the land and they're renting the house that they used to own and all that kind of thing. And what used to be 30 or 40 small farms is now one giant industrial operation. My guess is that that has affected the culture so that even the rice-growing cultures in the South that theoretically are interdependent are no longer interdependent, and they're more like the wheat cultures because everybody's just a tenant farmer. But I don't know.
Right, that makes sense.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense.
And I think that Reaganization of America, where, you know, it used to be that every small town was filled with small local businesses, and you knew when you bought something in the local store that it was made, you know, you bought some food in the local store that it was grown by a local farm family, and the money was going to the local community. And all, you know, there was a sense of interdependence. We used to have barn raisings in the United States. We, you know, a new family would move into town, and we'd show up and help them build a house or a barn. That doesn't happen anymore. And I think that we have moved in America. You know, the Wild West was just a myth. The West was actually, to the extent that it happened, I mean, you know, we were stealing land from the Indians, but setting that aside, it was still a collaborative effort. There were cooperative efforts. You know, these towns, they were living at the mercy of the elements and of, you know, the hostile Indians in some cases. And so there was a lot of collaboration. But now that every city looks the same, now that every city, the principal store is a Walmart, the principal restaurant is a TGI Fridays or a Hooters, you know, the principal auto shop is a Jiffy Lube. Now that the great homogenization has happened because of Reaganomics, I'm guessing that we have moved from kind of a rice culture in America in the 30s and 40s and 50s to a wheat culture today, and that's why you're seeing the rise of libertarianism. Make sense?
Right. It does make sense. I mean, the study, I guess all bets are off due to the trend in monopolization and agribusiness takeover of what once was family farming. So,
yeah.
So the,
I think so.
The conclusions really, yeah.
I think so. And I'll bet you're seeing the same thing down in Mexico where there used to be all these little family farms, and then we took all that cheap GMO corn down there and they all got wiped out, and now they're in the slums, and it's just amazing. Steve, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's so thought-provoking, you know, how just the simple dynamic of growing food, for example, leads to and affects not just culture but individual psychology. Minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and you know, movetoamend.org has inspired movements all over the country where states are trying to pass ballot initiatives. It's happened now in, what, 14, 15 states, something like that, where the state says, yes, if Congress sends us an amendment to the Constitution that says money's not speech and corporations aren't people, we will ratify it. That is the will of the people of this state. Well, they're trying to do that in the state of Washington. Libby Carr is on the line from wamend.org or wamend.org.
That's right, Tom. Wamend is the easiest way to do that.
Okay, wamend.org is the website. And Libby, how goes the effort there to get signatures on the ballot?
Well, it's going well. We're working hard every day. We have about 600 volunteers out there on the ground and
wonderful.
Collecting away.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it's going well. We're getting ready for Ben Cohen. Mm-hmm. He's coming out from Vermont with his Stampmobile.
Oh, that's great. And Ben of Ben & Jerry's, yep.
Right, right. He's really the social activist and has a huge passion for this issue, as you know.
Yeah.
So he's coming out to join us at Folklife and just bringing his credibility and knowledge of this area or of this issue and his national perspective. Because since he's been doing the Stampmobile, he's gone all over the country with talking with people about this issue.
That's marvelous. Libby, thank
you
for the heads up. And let's get, you know, let me encourage everybody to get over to wamend.org. If you're outside the state of Washington, you can still support the effort. And you can use this as an inspiration to do it in your state. If you're inside the state of Washington, sign up to volunteer to get signatures on the petition to get this thing on the ballot. Libby, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you. We'll talk tomorrow.
Great.
Thanks.
Great. Good talking to you. Diane in San Jose, California. Oh, by the way, Diane, before I get to you, all day long I've been trying to figure out what's the website if you want to see Bernie this weekend on Saturday in Iowa. It's Clinton County Democrats. .org is the website. It's the home site for the Clinton County Iowa Democrats, and Bernie's going to be their keynote speaker and for their Hall of Fame dinner on May 17th, which is this Saturday. And so Clinton County Democrats, spelled just the way you'd think it is, Democrats with an S dot O-R-G. Diane in San Jose, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine. You wanted to talk about the bullying topic, okay, which occupied our previous hour?
About the bullying, I didn't even know this about it until my sister told me about it, how she was bullied, okay?
Yeah.
When she was in grade school.
Yeah.
And she and I was shocked because I would have helped her. We were in a restaurant, and she said, you know, there was a girl who pointed her finger at me and said, you can't get up. So she had to stay on the bench for like days or weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, it was in grade school that I was bullied too. And that's, I think actually that's probably where it happens the most frequently and the worst, because those kids are, you know, over seven, they start, you know, they're little persons then, they're little, but they don't have the internal regulatory mechanisms, and a lot of them don't have the empathy built up. Diane, thanks for calling and sharing. Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm calling about our friend who called and saying that you don't need a driver's license. And I think I did hear you mention that. Did Chano find the case?
Yeah, the Supreme Court case that he was citing was not U.S. Supreme Court. It was Virginia Supreme Court, and it didn't say you don't need a driver's license. It said that the local authorities cannot capriciously or arbitrarily deny you a driver's license.
Right, and I looked this up. I walked in as you were going through this with him, and I took my shower, and I came back, and I looked this case up, and, of course, it's not a Supreme Court case. It's a Virginia Supreme Court case, but what I did, where that leads me directly, was to the blog that he was reading this from,
right,
a law enforcement blog. I found the exact page. I found the exact quote. And there's a bigger point here, Tom, because this is where these people, I don't know if they're teabaggers or whatever, but the what do they call themselves? The word escapes me.
Is this the sovereign citizens, the Clive and Bundy guys?
Yeah, the sovereign citizen. I read the entire thing. It starts out with, you have an absolute right to a guy who's writing this. I thought driving was a privilege, but the first case he cites is you have an absolute right to the highways. Case cited 1784. Okay?
Right.
You have an absolute right.
You have a right to ride a horse.
Yeah, right. You have a right, absolute right. This is before the Constitution.
Yeah.
Then it goes on to say that no state can convert a right into a privilege. Okay, now then it cites a Supreme Court case, Murdoch versus Pennsylvania. This was one of the Jehovah's Witness cases from the late 30s and 40s. There were three cases, and this one said that no, you can't require someone to have a license to do religious soliciting. Okay,
right.
You already have a right, free speech. These there were three.
Right, because religion is in the First Amendment, or the
right.
The First Amendment. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the next case it said they're confusing the right to drive with the right to travel. The other case it was cited was Kent versus Dulles, 1958, where a guy was denied a passport because they thought he might be a communist.
Right, and I kept pointing out to him the right to travel is a different thing from the right to operate a motor vehicle.
Exactly right. And here's the funny thing, Tom. In these cases, at least the recent ones, the Murdoch case, it was all the whole liberal wing of the court was found. It was a 5-4 decision. William O. Douglas wrote the opinion for the majority, you know, saying you don't have to have a license to do religious soliciting. It was all the conservative wing of the court. Reed, Roberts, Jackson, and Frankfurter, who said, no, you have to have a license to do religious soliciting. So they take these things, these sovereign citizen people, they take a little, you know, it's like the case of a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing.
Right.
They take these points that are completely, they're just klangfarben. They're completely separated and way far apart, and they draw them together as if to make a point that's completely irrelevant and erroneous.
Right. Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
Paul, thank you for, as always, thank you for the clarification, and thank you for listening to KBCS. Morris, listening to KPFK in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, you want to talk about Donald Sterling?
Yes, Professor. He's having a difficult time finding legal representation from Santa Barbara.
How can you have a difficult time finding legal representation if you're worth $1 billion?
they don't want the $50 million because they feel that he would be toxic to their other clients.
Amazing.
Yes, there's another point I wanted to share with you, Professor. Now, you remember the situation in Michigan where the Supreme Court shut down the affirmative action and Michigan has the right to vote yes or no on it. Now, suppose the top – now, we know who the top 250 athletes are in this country every year that are going to college because they're published. Now, suppose these athletes decided – now, we have to contact their parents because the kids don't know what's going on. But suppose we had folks that contacted their parents and said, don't allow your kid to attend a school – where they don't appreciate folks like your child attending their school, and if they don't improve their statistics, then your kid's not going to that school. Do you think that might get the eyebrow of people like Michigan?
I think it might, because the student athletes are generating billions of dollars for these schools, or at least hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's a great suggestion, Morris, and that's the kind of thing that, you know, a group like Color of Change or, you know, another activist, progressive activist group that works with issues around race really should grab hold of. Morris, thanks. That's absolutely brilliant. Appreciate it. Marty in Encinitas, California, watching on Free Speech TV. Marty, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I love your listeners. I feel such a community.
Oh, yeah. We've got some of the smartest.
All
in. Yeah, it's amazing.
Oh, it truly is amazing. And just before I make my comment regarding WaMend, I have ordered from Stamp Stampede the stamps. They're excellent quality, all wood, made in the United States, about getting money out of politics.
Cool.
Great products from Ben Cohen at StampStampede.org.
Okay.
My comment is that tea parties are a magical reality for kids at playtime. And our planet needs nonpartisan grown-ups willing to take responsibility for disseminating the truth and saving our lives.
Interesting.
That's it.
Okay, well said. I totally agree. Marty, thank you for the call. Doug in Denver, listening on AM 760. What's up, Doug?
Yes, I was lucky enough to meet you at one of your book signings out here.
Well, thank you.
And I love listening to your show. I learned so much. I wish I didn't have to work and could listen to it more. But your comment about rice and wheat, I just started thinking, what about government? Is that why China was communist? Is it communal because of a rice economy, a rice civilization?
Yeah. It makes you wonder, and Vietnam to this day is still a communist government, and I don't know about Laos and Cambodia, but one time they were. And it certainly seems that growing rice in this collaborative, cooperative way that is absolutely necessary, just, you know, physically, the physics of it, of growing the food, make collaboration and cooperation necessary, would certainly lend people toward the philosophy of communism, of communalism, of we're all in this together, of shared ownership of things, you know, from each according to his needs, or from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs, that kind of thing. Tragically, I don't think that kind of communism outside of kibbutzes, you know, once you get more than 200-300 people, once you have the ability for people to be anonymous, communism doesn't work, or at least it's never been demonstrated to work. And so tragically, communism in these countries has kind of morphed itself into authoritarianism in the guise of communism, which is unfortunate. But it may well account for why, you know, in the Cultural Revolution back in the 70s, 60s, 70s, whenever it was, that people were willing to buy into it. Makes a lot of sense. Doug, thanks for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Doug, thanks for listening to AM 760. Be sure to support their sponsors. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Richard in Monclova, Ohio. Say it. Tell me how it's pronounced, Richard.
Monclova.
Monclova, Ohio. Watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Hey, do you know the rest of the story about why the Southern Democrat separatists were able to get the Posse Comitatus law passed in 1876?
What I recently learned was that it was to get the northern occupying armies that were enforcing the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments out of their backyard and out of their hair.
But the reason they were able to get that passed
right
was that the election of 1876 between Samuel Tilden and Rutherford B. Hayes was disputed.
Oh, that's right. This was part of the compromise, wasn't it?
The abolitionist Republican, and due to some late-night shenanigans in the Secretary of State office in both the states of Louisiana and Florida, Hayes was declared the winner.
Right.
While most observers believe that Samuel Tilden actually won the popular vote in both states.
Mm-hmm.
So the Southern Democrats were extremely upset about this, but nobody really had the taste for another civil war over the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided on a compromise, and they voted that we'll get the Union troops out of the South in exchange for Rutherford B. Hayes being named the president.
For an abolitionist Republican as president, we will basically defang the abolitionists.
Yeah, and as soon as that happened, new laws went into effect limiting voting rights, travel ability, and everything else in the South, followed by Jim Crow, yada, yada.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I had forgotten that. I know that you're absolutely right, because when I first learned about Posse Comitatus, I also learned that piece of the history, and I had just forgotten it. It's one of my,
yeah, well,
like I said, it's a new learning for me.
This separatist, racist loop all back together again, too.
Say it again?
It sort of brings the whole racist and separatist loop back on itself.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, the Civil War never really ended, and this was—I mean, it ended as a war, but the cancer underneath it, slavery, and never really ended. It just took a different form. It was no longer overt slavery; it was a more subtle and covert form of slavery. But it was still the oppression of people based on their race, on the color of their skin, and it was institutionalized, and it was, say, sanctioned, at least in the South. And in different ways in the North. And the South became more subtle about it in ways that were happening in the North, as had been happening in the North even before the Civil War. And it's still with us to this day.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I see the echo of it in these Republican efforts to say, you know, if you're poor and live in an urban area, well, first of all, Paul Ryan saying that if you're poor and live in an urban area, in other words, poor and black, you must be lazy and you know, shiftless and all this kind of stuff. You got to have voter ID. And I told the story last week of 3 hours and four trips. You know, 3 hours it took me to make four trips to the DMV here in Washington, D.C. just to get my driver's license. And, you know, what an enormous hassle that would have been if they were actually actively trying to prevent me from getting it because of my race. This was just because of how hard they've made it in the name of voter. Defending America from the Weapons of Mass Deception, the Tom Hartman Program with you. John in Littleton, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, John, you wanted to talk about Occupy Wall Street?
Yeah, a couple of years ago we had the Wall Street. I'm changing the subject a little bit. I'm a big fan of yours.
Thank you.
But, you know, we have the Wall Street movement, and it had, you know, some success.
Yeah.
And I hear you and Gorman and a bunch of other, you know, liberal talks, show hosts, talking about how, you know, and I agree with you, that we have, you know, the conservatives really have the talk show things wrapped up pretty much.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, you know, we had Occupy Wall Street. Let's have Occupy Conservative Radio. Because you and me talking to each other are preaching to the choir, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So let's get all the Occupy people, and let's, and me, and I do it, call out conservative radio and show our views and how they're lying and how they're full of, you know, bunk.
Yeah, yeah.
And let's get every, I don't
here's
know.
The, here's the problem with that. Here's the problem with that as a strategy, John, and that is that while I believe in diversity of opinion, and I love debating people who disagree with me. And so if somebody calls in and says to Danielle, who's answering the phone today, if somebody calls in and says, you know, I think Tom is full of bunk and there's no such thing as climate change or whatever, They go to the top of the list. We actually, you know, prioritize our calls, and they go to the top of the list. I get flagged. I can see it on my call screen software. This person is a conservative. And they're the next caller because I like having those kind of conversations. On the other hand, most of these conservative talk shows, if you call in and give any indication whatsoever that you're going to disagree and you have any kind of an intelligent argument to make, you will never get put on the air, period. And in fact, Limbaugh used to complain about people who would lie about why they were going on the air so that they could get on the air and they could challenge him. And his call screeners have gotten very, very good at A, they don't take that many calls, but B, keeping liberals off the air. Same thing with the Hannity show, Beck show, all of these right-wing shows. It's very, very difficult for an intelligent liberal to get in. Now, if you're taking a liberal position and you don't understand it particularly well and you can easily be made a fool of on the radio, they will put you on the air. And perhaps that would be the way to, you know, to present yourself to the call screener. But I just, you know, that's not the solution. I think the solution, frankly, we have to acknowledge on the left, progressive talk radio needs to acknowledge that our biggest competition is not right-wing talk radio, it's NPR. And number two, that NPR is becoming more and more corporate and more right-wing, and you're starting to see constantly on NPR people from Heritage Foundation and Competitive Enterprise Institute and whatnot, these right-wing funded groups showing up, right-wing Republicans being given the opportunity to basically present, John, thank you for the call, to present what are basically lies without challenge. I'm hearing this constantly on NPR, and it's making me crazy. We're seeing the corporatization and the right-wingization of national, what some people refer to as National Petroleum Radio. I think it's a tragedy. And at a certain level, I'm wondering if we're being well served as a nation by NPR, by having NPR. This was an invention of the Lyndon Johnson administration. The idea was to follow BBC and have completely unbiased news, period. And BBC still does it, and they do a fairly good job of it, but there's these layers of management that are independent of politics. And NPR, in my opinion, has not been successful in doing that. Secondly, at the level of AM talk radio, because Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act back in 1982, it used to be, the biggest talk show host in the country used to be Alan Berg back in the 70s. He was out of a huge station in Denver. You could hear him in 34 states. Then you had another station out in San Francisco. I think it was KGO. I could be wrong. That had a number of progressives in their lineup, and they were blowing a signal from Mexico all the way up to Alaska. And so, you know, but Alan Berg got machine gunned to death in the late 70s or early 80s by the Aryan Nation, by a couple of skinheads. I mean, he literally, in his driveway, was shot to death. They made a movie out of it called Talk Radio. And so there was this kind of interregnum, this pause for a couple of years where there wasn't any talk radio. And then Limbaugh came along in, I think, 86, 87. It was the year Reagan stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine, although that had nothing to do with it. The Fairness Doctrine basically said that you've got to have real news. It didn't say if you've got a lefty, you've got to have a righty or anything like that. But Limbaugh came along, and he was quite successful. And I think he was successful because NPR, here's the reality. America is a center-left nation. And NPR had historically been a center-left network because, reality is center-left. The majority of people in America want strong social security systems. The majority of people in America actually are concerned about global warming. The majority of people would love to have a single-payer healthcare system. The majority of people in America think that we should have unions and you should have a right to work, not a right to work for less. The majority of people in America think that the commons is an important thing. And so how does the Republican Party and how does conservative talk radio counter that? And I think that they've done it by consolidation of media. And if we were to go back to the days when you had thousands of independently owned stations across the country, stations like WCPT and KKZ, or K, I'm forgetting the call letters, our station in Minneapolis, KTNF, yeah, thank you. And I mean, we've got some great independent stations out there. I think that you would see a real revival and renewal of progressive talk radio. And we're progressive. Our show is growing like crazy on Pacifica stations, on nonprofit stations, on free speech TV, on TuneIn, on Progressive Voices channel, on TuneIn Radio. So there's the demand there. And I think as NPR goes more and more corporate, more and more right wing, there'll be more and more opportunities. But anyhow, just, you know, WBAI, KPFK, good on you. We'll be back tomorrow. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag your
Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.